actual work itself, while also signaling to the audience that this is a very specific genre and attract the right people to the book that you know will find satisfaction from reading it. So, you know, at some point in the future, Tim and I should really do more about, especially for everyone just globally interested in how you translate a story into a product. I think, you know, that would be a pretty cool thing to do. But when I actually saw the final cover, which took about four different creative forces to come together and coalesce into that one package, I was really, really happy with it, because I think it says big epic fantasy story along with it's uniquely familiar. I think that's the thing you're always shooting for, is to be uniquely, specifically brand new, but of a type. So, yeah.
Cool.
I'll stop talking about the cover.
All right. All right. So let's jump in here. This is from Scott. From time to time during my writing projects, whole chunks of writing somehow connected to that project will burble up in my brain. Snatches of dialogue, a landscape description from no place I've ever seen, a sudden insight into a character's motivation, these come in no particular order. I jot them down while the idea is still hot. I can't tell if these are fool's gold or genuine morsels from the muse. Right now, I'm just stockpiling them in a notebook, not wanting to get distracted from the story grid structure. Prior to story grid, I would try to stitch these random snippets immediately into my story, which explains a stack of manuscripts that went nowhere. What's to be done with ideas like these?
Well, you're doing the right thing. We all have these wonderful things that come to us, and I do think that they're from the collective unconscious, from our own internal stuff, and writing them down so you don't forget them is really a good idea. Using them is a very specific tool that you start to learn the more you write. And it sounds like Scott's already started to learn this, in that, you know, an editor can always see when somebody stitched together a bunch of stuff that they got from the collective unconscious and try to make it a scene, because it just doesn't feel authentic or true or real. So if you have these moments of a great description or a turn of phrase, writing them down is going to sort of make a place marker in your mind. And then as you are writing, and then you just kind of just put it aside. So I've got files and files and files of stuff, even emails that I email my stuff, myself, that are these ideas about projects or things like that. And I never actually return to them unless I really think it through. But I know that when I'm starting a new project, all that stuff is sort of embedded in my mind. So I think the strategy that Scott has is to have a journal that you can write all this stuff down in. And then if you ever hit a point where you go, oh my gosh, that description I came up with on that walk would be perfect here, then you'll go dig it up. And what you're going to find is it's probably not that great. But what it will do is go, this is a good start, right? And then it'll help you prime the pump in coming up with something fresh. So I tip my hat to Scott, because that's exactly the strategy that I would recommend. It's not fool's gold. It's not the best thing ever either. It's somewhere in between, and it's a great problem-solving device for very specific problems.
Okay. This one's from Anne. In thinking about Stranger Knocks at the Door scenes, Gandalf with the Hobbit, Hagrid with Harry Potter, etc., it seems like this scene is generally found in the beginning hook. Can you think of any reasons why examples of it appearing later in the story? Seems like the need to have all major characters introduced in the first half of the story would make this kind of development feel contrived if it came too late, but I'm wondering if it might be more flexible than I'm imagining.
No, that's a good heuristic. Stranger Knocks at the Door is, it's very much one specific tool to drop in a big unexpected event. So if you do Stranger Knocks at the Door to set up your ending payoff, it might work if, I'm just trying to think of an example. I can't think of one specifically, but I can think of an abstract example. In Tim's novel. In Tim's novel, he sets up the notion of Randy at the very beginning of the story. And so what that does for the audience is it sets like a place marker in their mind. Hey, I wonder what happened to that Randy guy. And so when Tim does bring Randy in, he does it as a stranger knocks on the door in a very interesting way. So when Jesse falls through the matrix into the matrix within the matrix, at the middle build, right about the middle build shift, she discovers that she has found Randy. So it's almost as if Jesse becomes the stranger knocking on the door into the Randy universe, the Randy world. And then Randy, actually, we're never really sure, was Randy responsible for her getting through that portal, or was Jesse? And we do have that resolved at the very end of the novel, but at the time, we tend to think that it's Randy who has knocked on the door and dropped Jesse in. Now, that's a midpoint shift where you have Stranger Knocks at the Door, so it's not in the beginning hook, and I think it works. And the reason why it works is because it was set up. Now, there's also a novel I recall from the 90s called The Deep End of the Ocean, which was about a young child who disappears. And I believe the child comes back sometime later in the story. But my advice about using Stranger Knocks at the Door is that it's a great device to use with big shifts, right? So if you're moving from, when Hagrid comes in Harry Potter, he's the threshold guardian and a stranger knocking at the door, and he says, "You're a wizard, Harry," right? So that's a big emotional shift where Harry Potter's just this kid living under the stairs, and all of a sudden, this stranger drops in and says, "Actually, you're a wizard." So that's a big unexpected event. It's a big P-H-E-R-E that moves the story and transitions it from Harry's ordinary world into the exploration of an extraordinary world. So think of Stranger Knocks at the Door as the as a character embodying fear, the unexpected event that brings a big shift in the story. So to use Stranger Knocks at the Door in a smaller value shift in a sequence of events, I would probably steer you away from doing that. Stranger Knocks at the Door is really about, it's a tool to use for big moments. So say you're writing a first draft and you can't figure out how to transition into the middle build. And you're racking your mind and you go, "Oh shit, I haven't used Stranger Knocks at the Door. Let me try that." Or say you're having a difficulty shifting from the first part of the middle build into the second part. You might want to do a Stranger Knocks at the Door there. So you can do it. I'm you know, as I'm talking, I'm coming up with sort of a heuristic for everyone. So I would think it's a great global inciting incident, like in The Hobbit. Great global insight. That's the first scene of The Hobbit. Stranger knocks at the door. Gandalf knocks at Bilbo Baggins' door. And then it's a really good transition to transition from beginning hook into middle build. That's sort of Harry Potter-ish. And then for Tim, he uses it for the midpoint shift of the Thresher. Now, is it possible to use it for the transition from middle build two into the ending payoff? Probably. It might be something where, like I was talking about, the deep end of the ocean, where the child returns after 15 years of nobody knows where he is. I think that's probably more of a middle build or beginning hook shift. So generally, I would steer clear of using Stranger Knocks at the Door beyond the midpoint shift.
Okay. This question's from Jewel. If there is a conflict between two characters in a scene so that one person wins the scene and the other person loses the scene, who wins and who loses the Stranger Knocks on the Door scene from No Country for Old Men? Does Javier win because he's dictating the terms all the way through, or does the gas station man win because he doesn't get killed? Or does randomness win because a flip of the coin resolve the conflict?
Well, I could talk about this scene for days, but I love the question. Okay, so well, I'm trying to approach this in stages. Okay. There's a whole slew of levels to this scene. So let's go on the most obvious level of the scene. Let's say the desire for Javier Bardem, his want at the beginning of this scene, is to pay as little as possible for his gas and his peanuts. Let's say that's what he wants. So at the end of this scene, does he get what he wants? I would say he does, because he didn't pay anything but a quarter. He paid one quarter and he got a bag of 69-cent nuts and all the gas in his tank for a quarter. He won what he wanted. Now, in that case, the man who owns the gas station lost, because he's out the price of the gas plus 69 cents minus 25 cents. So at the very, very obvious external want level, the loser is the cashier. Okay, so let's go in another level down. Let's say the need for Javier Bardem in this scene, what he needs is to get his gas filled up and to be undetected. He does not want anyone to know his whereabouts because he's a homicidal killer. And there are people who are trying to find him. There's the police, and there's even his employer who's trying to find him to stop him from doing what he's doing or to encourage him to do it faster. So what Javier Bardem needs is safety. He needs to be safe from the pursuit of outside forces who want to destroy him. So that's what he needs at the beginning of the scene. What happens in the scene is he gets what he needs, doesn't he? Because he has scared the shit out of the cashier, and he's let the cashier know that he has no problem whatsoever killing him. Not a problem. I can come back at 9:30 when you're in bed. Would you prefer that? So there's no doubt in the cashier's mind that Javier Bardem is going to kill him. Okay. So the fact that the cashier knows that means he will be terrified to give away the fact that Bardem was, or Chigurh, whatever his name is, in the Anton Chigurh, that he actually came to the gas station. So is it a perfect need? Probably not. There's a level of safety that Chigurh is not going to have by keeping this guy alive. Dead men don't talk. So Bardem kind of loses when it comes to the need, right? So his need is complete safety at the beginning, and the scene ends with him being a little bit vulnerable. No matter how much you scare somebody, they can give up information quickly if they're alive. All right. So that's another level. So let's look at it from the point of view of the cashier. So the cashier is bored out of his mind, right? So what he wants is a little interaction with another human being. So that's what his actions are all about, right? He has no interest really where this guy is from. He just says, hey, you getting any rain where you're up from, or whatever he says. And he actually does get what he wants. He does get a deep psychological social interaction that he will never forget, right? So what he wants is social interaction, is an ability to have communication with another human being. The scene ends and he gets what he wants. Not in the way he thought he would, but he does get what he wants. Now, what does the cashier need? The cashier needs to stay alive. At the beginning of the scene, he's alive. At the end of the scene, he's alive. So he gets what he needs too. So the cashier has, we're looking at this sort of through like a game theory, you know, way of looking at it, which is kind of fun. So the cashier gets what he wants and he gets what he needs. Javier Bardem gets what he wants, but doesn't get what he needs. So somebody won the scene. The cashier won the scene. But the cashier won the scene through random chance, because Chigurh flips the coin and he allows the universe, the random fall of a coin on a counter, determine who gets to win. So because the cashier won the toss of the coin, he gets to live. If he had lost, he would have died. So what's beautiful in this scene is that it speaks to the uncertainty of every freaking thing in our life. So stories, by my estimation, these are, I don't want to get too much into complexity theory, but stories are complicated systems that try to mirror the complexity of life. Complexity simply means that we can never be certain of anything, generally. Now, story is complicated. Complicated means that we can find certainty because we are the creators of our stories. So this scene is so remarkable to me because it undermines the whole storytelling paradigm with the flip of that freaking coin. And it's the climax of the entire novel and the movie too. And we're never really sure if the woman at the end of the movie and in the novel survives or dies, because we don't know whether that coin flipped in her favor or against her favor. So The point of this scene is to bring in wins and who loses. So the behavior of the human beings in this scene doesn't really matter. All that matters is what happens with that coin flip. Someone is either going to live or die by the toss of a coin. That is a metaphor for everything that we experience in our life. No matter how many freaking plans we have, unexpected fears drop into our lives and upset the balance of what we want and what we need, so that we can never be certain of anything. And we are now in a moment of the most purest uncertainty in my entire lifetime. It's a remarkable place for all of us to be, and to think of our position existentially right now, it's very interesting. We're not really sure of anything. And this scene speaks to that uncertainty. We cannot control the universe, no matter how much we think we can. Well, if I'm just nice to that person, then, you know, everything will be okay. Well, obviously not. And also, I love this scene because it speaks to our every action, every motor action, everything we do is embedded in the entire real space of our Earth arena, right? So, and that's what Shigure is explaining to this guy, whether he understands it or not. So the guy is just, hey, I'm just making simple conversation here. That action has repercussions, right? Because that action puts forward into the world to Shigure, I have noticed your license plate. I will be able to recall that you were from Dallas and that you came in with on a license plate from Dallas, if anyone ever asks me, which has an equal reaction to Shigure. He immediately, the alarm bells go off in Shigure's mind, and he goes, this idiot can give me up. I'm going to kill this guy, because the minute the police show up or the bad guys are trying to get me, he's going to blurt out everything he knows about me. So this simple action of this guy making, you know, just average, normal conversation can kill him. That action, that motor action of, are you getting any rain up your way? That simple sentence could be his death sentence. So every action that we put into the world changes the world, because that changed Shigure, and it actually threatens the life of the cashier. So this scene, for me, has so many different levels, and it speaks to me and the, believe it or not, the existential condition of man and women on this planet. And it's so damn entertaining, too. I mean, the haircut alone is enough to just make you smile. So the answer to the question is, in my estimation, the winner of the scene is the cashier, and he wins the scene only through random chance, which is a metaphor for we're all winning every freaking day, every moment of our life, because an asteroid has not hit the Earth yet. So it's a really cool scene. I hope that answers the question.
All right, so to follow up about the stranger knocks at the door scene, there's been a lot of discussion about what constitutes this type of scene. Questions like, can the protagonist be the stranger? Can the reader know who the stranger is but not the other character in the scene? Can the stranger bring good news? And so on. Could you speak for a few minutes about what this scene type is all about and when an author might use it in her story?
What this scene is about is it boils down, it anthropomorphizes what I talk about when I talk about fear. So when I talk about P-H-E-R-E, simply all it means is something happens that we didn't expect to happen. Okay. So the stranger is the embodiment of the unexpected. A stranger, by definition, is unexpected because we've never seen them before. We don't know what their agenda is. We don't know anything about them. So the stranger as a concept, Camus' stranger, is about the unexpected behavior of humanity, of human beings. So the stranger knocking at the door is a delicious, brilliant, amazing concept that came from thousands and hundreds of thousands of years ago. How do we react to an unexpected event? So, because it's the embodiment of the unexpected, uncertain nature of reality, we can go to town. We can do all kinds of things with it, right? Some people, I would say police detectives, they recognize their power position of being the stranger. So whenever you have a detective scene where the detective knocks on the door, or it's a police, a cop, it's usually plainclothes detectives, right? And they knock on the door, it's stranger knocks at the door, because the person on the other side of the door has never seen this person before. And all these suspicions are running in their minds about what's going to happen. What are they going to do? So stranger knocks at the door that's an example of the protagonist. If you're writing a mystery story with a master detective or police detective, if your protagonist understands the power of being the stranger who also has a gun, that's going to be helpful for you when you're charting out scenes. So the purpose of stranger knocks at the door is to really concretize, to make concrete the concept of the unexpected event. So that's why I recommend you use it sparingly, and you use it to turn big moments of scene. Don't blow a stranger knocks at the door scene to let somebody know that their car is double parked. You know, that's not a really good progressive complication to begin with, unless they're robbing a bank, right? And then so the purpose of these is to really make the unexpected, uncertain nature of reality very clear to the audience. And what happens is, now, yes, there are a whole bunch of techniques that you can use. Actually, there's three of them for dealing with whether or not the reader knows who the stranger is and what they're doing, right? So I'm trying to remember this. Narrative drive. I wrote a piece for Steve's website years ago about narrative drive. There's mystery, and the mystery means the characters know more information than the audience knows. There's suspense, and suspense is when the characters and the audience are on the same level. They have the same amount of information. So we're like, if we're in a horror movie and we're watching a character move down a hall and the lights go out and they have to go into a room, we don't know what's on the other side of the room, that's suspense. Mystery is when the character knows that the shotgun's on the other side of the room and the reader doesn't, and so we follow them and we think, don't open that closet, and they open the closet and there's a shotgun in there. We go, oh, they're getting their shotgun. So that's mystery, right? And the last one is dramatic irony. And dramatic irony is when the audience knows more than the characters. Okay. So when you're doing your stranger knocks at the door, it's good to think about this. What device am I using to tell this story, to keep the narrative pace going? Am I going with pure mystery? Am I going with suspense? Or am I going with dramatic irony? My recommendation is don't do dramatic irony until act three, until the ending payoff. Just as a general heuristic, Silence of the Lambs does dramatic irony in the hero at the mercy of the villain scene, and that's the only time the audience knows more than Clarice Starling. So generally, you know, you use mystery at the beginning until the audience sort of aligns and sympathizes and finds empathy with the central protagonist. And then in the middle build, you can start getting into suspense. So in Tim's novel, there's a lot of mystery at the beginning of his story. We're not really sure what this world is about, what this girl is doing, what credits are, what the threshing, what blah, blah. We don't really know that. But by the time we get to the middle build, we're caught up. And when Jesse starts going through her severing tests, we're walking along with her as she's going through, you know, the action. And then at the end, I don't think we ever do get into dramatic irony in Tim's novel, off the top of my head. And that's smart because it's the first in the trilogy. Anyway, so when you're doing Stranger Knocks at the Door, think about these things. Now, as I said earlier, in terms of heuristics, the chances of using dramatic irony for Stranger Knocks at the Door, probably not going to want to do it. Unless you're a master craftsperson who has been writing for, like maybe Stephen King could do it very, very successfully. I don't know that I could off the top, you know. So I would suggest you want your audience to not know who the stranger is. Now in No Country for Old Men, we do know. So we have more information about Sugar than the cashier does. That's dramatic irony. But we're not really ever sure what Sugar is going to do. We're not really sure of what, what his complete and total ethos is. Until the end of the story, we know everything we need to know about Sugar. He's the random nature of uncertainty in life. He's never going away. He's always going to repair himself and get back on his feet. He's always going to interrupt our lives. He's resistance. He's a lot of different things. So the great thing about this scene is all of these questions about the variables in the question that was posed to me are things to play with. Hey, I don't know. What if your protagonist is the stranger? Try it. How's that going to work? Does it work? What if you use dramatic irony? Is that going to work? Yeah, maybe it will, right? I can't really say one thing's going to work or not going to work, or I can only give these abstract heuristics and recommendations, and it's up to the writers and the craftspeople and the storytellers to try them in different ways and see if they work for them. You know, I think if anybody said to you, all right, here's the scene set up. You're gonna have a killer walk into a gas station and he's gonna get in some kind of verbal confrontation with the cashier and he's gonna flip a coin to decide whether or not the guy wins his, whether or not he's going to kill the guy or not. A, I there's no way if somebody gave me that rubric and that prompt that I would have been able to write what Cormac McCarthy wrote. Right? It would have been a little ham-fisted. It would have been on the nose. Hey, what do you mean you looked at my license plate? How dare you? Don't you know that, right? That's what we would do. We wouldn't learn that subtext of how to say things without directly saying them. But, you know, you write some shitty drafts and then you go, oh, that's way on the nose, but at least I know what he's trying to get across. I know his essential action, right? And then you can, this is probably what Cormac McCarthy did. He probably wrote a bad scene and then he kept tweaking it and tweaking it and tweaking it. So the answer to all those variables and the question is you got to try it yourself. I can't tell you whether or not it'll work or not unless I read it. And I'm not going to read all of your stuff.
Okay, this one's from Dana. How do you select the genre of your book if two seem equally appropriate?
Okay. This is going to require probably some emotional pain. because each genre represents the global pursuit of a particular need or value, right? So we value certain things in order to get what we need. So if you're torn between two genres, what it means is that you are torn personally as the creator between two pursuits of needs that you know that you require. So the answer to the question is that need that you find within yourself that you think you will never get satisfied or has the least probability of satisfaction, that's the one you should work on. Because I truly believe that we tell stories not just as a means to entertain and educate others, but as the means to self-examine. And if you're doing a story based upon a need that isn't fully raw within your own self, you're not going to get to the molten lava of within yourself that's going to be able to come up with. I suspect Cormac McCarthy, when he wrote No Country for Old Men, was considering his own existence. What does it mean to be old in this country? I'm slowly dying. Nothing makes sense to me anymore. What is this about? How am I going to continue on when nothing makes any sense to me anymore? And that need for understanding and attunement with the rest of the world, because we all want to attune ourselves to reality. And the further away we get from reality, the more upsetting it is. So we have a deep need to be attuned to fit in, to get it. We want to be part of something larger than ourselves. So this is why we find tribes. This is why we find places to fit in so that we can share language and understanding with like-minded people. So that this group we can all talk about stories probably for the until we all die. We could all sit on this Zoom call and talk about this stuff, because that's, it's a need that we all have and we all share, and we feel comfortable in this tribe. So when you're trying to pick a genre, you have to think about, what is the core need here? What is the thing that I am most interested in resolving within myself? If it's a performance story, you're probably interested in the phenomena of hard work that you have done over your life that has never been recognized. How are you going to get that need met of being recognized and respected as a important contributor to the collective unconscious? And so you write a story that concerns someone performing, and they either get that or they don't. But while you're writing that story, guess what you have to do? You have to think about the times, the situations, the specificity of the moments in your own life when shit did not work out for you, and how it pushed you further to try and get what you needed in different ways. So if you're torn between, I don't believe that the story works with one or the other genre. I believe that you know, you absolutely know which one to do. And it's the one that scares you the most, because it's going to make you really uncomfortable. It's going to make you do things and think about things that you don't necessarily want to think about. But that's what's going to make the story transformational, whether or not anybody ever reads it. It's going to transform you as the creator. So pick the one that scares you the most and say to yourself, hey, I know going into this, I'm going to freak out, and something's going to hit me at some point that is going to make me want to quit. I know that going in. So when that comes, I'm going to make a note to myself and say, there will come a moment when you're going to want to quit, and you're going to have a million reasons why that makes sense. And when you see that card pasted to your wall and that moment hits, you're going to say, son of a bitch, I guess I was ready for this. All right, here I go. Well, maybe I'll take today off. But the chances are, the more you look at that card, the stronger you're going to be, because you're going to be able to understand the process of what you're doing. And you're going to say, well, this is a pretty good process. If I'm able to predict what's going to happen to me in 6 months and it actually happens, maybe I'm onto something here. And that's the way to pick a genre, the one that makes you uncomfortable.
All right. This one's from Alyssa. In StoryGrid, you said something, so the book StoryGrid, you said something along the lines of the thriller being the genre for our times. Do you think this is still true? Do you believe a different genre will take over in the coming years?
I think it is still true. I think what we're finding are I don't know how popular the thriller will be, but I do think it certainly makes sense for our time, because the thriller is about safety. And it's about reality, and it's about dealing with real unexpected events, not super monster, crazy, uncanny, horrific, horror. Like the chances of aliens landing us having an alien battle are pretty slim, right? And it comes directly to the ordinary person. So thrillers are extraordinary circumstances that are personal. So whether, no matter what we all say, we take everything personally, and the thriller is all about making it personal. So the threat and the horror and the pain is applied directly to the protagonist. And I think every single person on the planet right now is directly feeling the unexpected pain of our moment in time. Now, with that said, I don't know that the thriller as a commercial enterprise right now is going to sweep the nation. And the reason why, it's a little bit too close to home. I think we're all living a thriller. So if you're living the thriller world, what do you do to leave that experience that will recalibrate your framing of the world in a way that will be helpful? And I think that this is why we had these big sort of fantastical stories from the Marvel Universe and things of that nature that are compelling us, because they have deep monomythic structures within them, heroic journey structures. I'm working on sort of the story grid's interpretation of the heroic journey, using story grid stuff, so that it's not all about, it's a little bit dusty in my estimation. I think it's a little bit, I'm trying to frame cognitive science on top of heroic journey, because I think that's what the heroic journey is. I think the heroic journey is opening up our frame. It's opening up our minds to new ideas and rejiggering the way we see the world in an integrative fashion, so that all of the knowledge that we've had previously gets refreshed in a higher resolution with a bigger sensibility of understanding. I think that's what every single story that embeds that mission inside of it speaks to us. And we say, yes, that's true. That's right. The Hobbit is true. We don't think that there was a dragon, you know, guarding gold, but we say that's true. That's what you have to do to make it through this world. You've got to suck it up, and you got to go down into that cavern, and you've got to confront that freaking dragon, and you got to take what is yours, and you have to slay that son of a bitch. We all know that to be absolutely fucking true. That's what we need more of. And the problem we're living in, I think, is nobody is saying that. And nobody's saying, we got this problem. Here are the tools that we can use to solve this kind of problem. You go over there and you work on that problem. I'll work on this one. And then we're going to get together and we're going to figure this shit out. Instead, we're getting all this misdirected information. It's just this ecosystem of information that is overwhelming. And it's impossible to make sense of. So I think those stories, like fantasy stories that go back into an alternate universe, science fiction, that abstractly tell us what the fuck to do when you're faced with the kind of situation we're in, thematically, people will find faith. They will go, that's what we need to do. We need to do what the Hobbit did, or we need to do what, name your fantasy novel of choice. So I think the thriller, unless it's highly stylized or super specific to a particular kind of thing, like unreliable narrator, stranger on a train stuff that has been milked, I think that might be over, by the way. The woman in the door and the thing and the train and all those kind of things, I think might be played out. But I think epic stories that deal with big, big psychological issues that threaten everyone. That's a fantasy story. Fantasy stories go for the gusto. They go for the big, big wallop, the big picture, the big thematic stuff. So that's what I think is going to speak to people today, because it'll allow them to escape the reality of the thriller we're living in a world that will be helpful to navigate the thriller world.
Okay. This is from Megan. I'm evaluating word count for my scenes. How similar should word count be from scene to scene? For example, is 1500 to 2000 okay? A 500 word difference, or should they all be closer to one number?
I would actually put scene word count on the back burner of your thinking. It's almost beside the point when you're writing or when I'm writing. I always say to myself, I'm just going to keep going. I'm going to end this scene and I'm going to keep going to the next scene. And then like second, third draft, I might go, oh shit, I've got 4,000 or 5,000 word scenes in a row. Maybe I can doctor that up and cut them up to get more fluidity. I can take a chunk here. I wouldn't worry so much about the word count on a scene when you're writing. In fact, I would avoid even thinking about it. That's more of a sort of abstract intellectual practice to do as an editor when you're looking at your spreadsheet, right? So this is why we do that damn spreadsheet to begin with, because it does is gives us continuity and it gives us factual information. So when you look at the factual information and you see scene number one, 5,000 words, scene number two, 5,000 words, scene number three, 5,000 words, scene number four, 40 words, you go, oh, whoa, we got to do something here. So so when you're writing, just if your scene is 700 words, cool. Next. You can always flesh it out. Tim wrote a lot of scenes that were 600 words that on the seventh draft, he inflated to like 1,200 to 1,500. Because what he did is he left out all that shit that you can put in later, like descriptions of the streetscape or the way somebody, their hair, or their physical appearance, all that detail you can dump in later. So my advice is don't worry about the word count when you're writing. When you are editing, then yeah, you wanna go for a variety, anywhere from 1,200 to 1,500 to 2,000, like for the big seat cast of 100 scene, it could be 4,000 words. That's okay. Just break it up in a way that is interesting and think of it in terms of like editing a movie. And that's how to fix those big monster scenes, is to think of it cinematically.
All right. This is from Sarah. Should our goal be to use all these sprint scenes in a book?
I'm just trying to run through them in my mind. What? No. The goal is to have a catalog of go-to stuff for when you get stuck. So I suspect all of you have written all of these scenes before, but you never classified them as a category of scene or a scene type. So now that you know that there are specific scene types, when you get stuck on your magical writing adventure and you go, shit, what should I do for this next scene? Then what you could do is pull up a catalog of all these scenes that you've done on these sprints and go, hey, maybe I can adapt that thing here and drop it in. Now, eventually what you're going to discover is that there become these scene types end up being used in specific genres at specific times, and they become conventions or obligatory moments in specific genres or tropes. I don't want to get into, basically all the stuff that we're doing has direct applicability across multiple levels of analysis of story structure. So whenever, you know, the best laid plans of mice and men, if you say to yourself, I'm going to lay out my entire novel based upon scene type, go. And then you bang them all out. Hey, it might work, but it also might feel a little bit contrived. And it might not feel natural and it might not flow. So I wouldn't recommend that you do that. What I would recommend is that you build a catalog of scene types, examples of scenes that you've written of that type, plus masterwork scenes that you can use to inspire new iterations. So, you know, eventually we might have a really nice catalog of, say, I'm pulling this out of my head, 100 scene types, and we've got 5 examples of each individual kind of type. Let's say we have 12 examples of each individual type for every single global genre. So we would have 1,200 scenes, 100 scene types, and one scene type for each global genre. I think that's absolutely doable. It's a matter of time and hard work. But I know there's at least 100 scene types. But I think there is a limit. And the concept of scene type I've discovered is a rather original one that I've kind of always thought everybody knew, but that apparently they don't. So it's kind of cool because we're on the cutting edge of sort of this thing. Maybe they're called tropes in other languages, but no, the point isn't to use these to write a novel. It's to use these when you get stuck, when you're writing a novel.
All right, so we'll end with this one from Allison. Is the scene where Bilbo goes into the mountain to meet Smaug a stranger knocks at the door scene? Because there is change there, he becomes the burglar.
Well, if this was called The Smaug, yeah. What I mean by that is that this harkens back to an earlier question about whether or not the protagonist can be the stranger. And this is a really, and it also harkens back, can you use Stranger Knocks at the Door for the ending payoff? Now, whether or not I would call that a Stranger Knocks at the Door, I don't know that I would, because I would look at the scene through the point of view of the protagonist and the global arc of the global story, as opposed to looking at the scene from the point of view of a secondary character. Now, from the point of view of Smaug, it is sort of Stranger Knocks at the Door, but he doesn't knock at the door. He's a burglar. So it would be probably an attack scene from Smaug's point of view. Now, from Bilbo's point of view, it would probably be called something like the heist scene. Like what happens as he's trying to secure the riches underneath Smaug's. And I think he steals one goblet or something, and Smaug actually knows that the goblet is missing. And then they have that sort of Socratic dialogue. But I wouldn't call that Stranger Knocks at the Door, because it is not unexpected from the point of view of the reader audience, nor is it an unexpected motor action for the protagonist. So you can see how you can, once you fall off of the main through line of the global story, this is a story, The Hobbit is the story of Bilbo Baggins. And Smaug is a secondary character. So when Bilbo Baggins goes to get the treasure, that's not Stranger Knocks at the Door. That's more like hero going for victory or whatever. I'm sorry, I don't have the perfect language to describe that scene right now, but I wouldn't call it Stranger Knocks at the Door. And I hope that's clear why it's not.
Okay, we're right at the top of the hour. So let's end there. Thanks, Sean.
Thank you. See you on Monday.
All right. and I think Allison is taking over from here.